My theme for these sessions is going to be on the material and spiritual worlds. This, of course, is an alarmingly abstract kind of subject, and one might well approach it saying to oneself, I'm not going to understand this. It's going to be some abstruse philosophic thing. That may well be true, but with a little bit of luck, as we proceed during these four sessions, it'll become somewhat more concrete, somewhat less abstract, and its relevance to the five-year plan will become even more apparent. The five-year plan, of course, is in its dying stages to conclude at Rizwan 2011, but I understand on good authority that the House of Justice is quite relentless and that it is preparing, and may well have distributed already, a very lengthy message to the members of the Continental Boards of Councillors gathered at the World Centre at this time in preparation for the next five-year plan commencing at the forthcoming Rizwan. Let me now proceed to my subject. As we are all aware, we find in creation a material world of sense perceptions, which we can measure by instrument or by banging ourselves on the table or anything like that, and it is subject to scientific inquiry. The world of the senses of various kinds, the world that is measured by instruments of a variety of types. We who are Baha'is and those who follow other religions of the world are also aware that there is another world and that we're living in that other world at the self-same time, the world of spiritual forces known by their effect and creating a spiritual world of values and entities. So it is that we human beings, at this stage in our creation, dwell simultaneously in two worlds, the material world and the spiritual world. We also know that any actions we take are actions in those two worlds, and that the actions we take have an effect in both worlds. In some instances, this effect is fairly predictable and fairly well known to followers of religion. For example, take prayer. Prayer is an action in the material world. You take the book, you open it up, you find the right page, and you recite certain words. A materialistic perspective would say that's all it is. Person in an empty room whispering things. But we know from our knowledge that there are two worlds, spiritual, material, that this prayer can, if it is recited with devotion and attention, that it has a spiritual effect. It has an effect which involves spiritual powers. So any action we take has both a material and a spiritual consequence. In most cases it's fairly predictable, but in some cases it is unpredictable. And the main purpose of my presentations at the summer school is to share with you my understanding of the interaction between the material and spiritual dimensions of creation. As I say, in most cases, it's fairly obvious and we don't need to get too excited about it, but in other instances, it's very strange. And I want to give you three examples of strange phenomena which arise from the interaction between the material and spiritual dimensions of creation. There are, of course, many possible examples. Most of them are exaggerated or there's some kind of pious fraud or something like that. But I want to suggest to you three examples which are very strange and which are well documented in reliable Baha'i literature. Okay. That's not one of them, that's something else. The first of these three is mentioned in the Kitab-e-Ikan. And in it, Baha'u'llah refers to the fact that when the time approaches for the appearance of a manifestation of God, a sign appears in the visible heaven as well as the invisible heaven. In other words, what he says is that a star will appear in the heaven, in the visible heaven, upon the sea, heralding unto the people the advent of the most great light. This, I want to suggest to you, is extremely strange. What I get from it is that when a manifestation of God is about to appear on this earth, a visible sign appears in the heavens. We can take it all spiritually very easily without getting bent out of shape, but Baha'u'llah points out that it also has a material meaning, a star in the visible heavens. And of course, those of us who've survived the Christmas carols of the last few days have been inundated with all this thing and the three wise men following the star to Bethlehem. That happened 2,000 years ago. There's a lot of controversy about what it meant and whether it really happened and all the rest of it. We can ignore all that. We have Baha'u'llah telling us in the Kitab-e-Ikan that this phenomenon occurs authentically in the visible as well as the invisible worlds. And it's very strange. What we might ask is the connection between a manifestation appearing on this planet on Earth and a star appearing in the visible sky. What is the mechanism connecting these two events? And how does it all relate to astronomy and to the accuracy with which the movement of celestial bodies is predicted nowadays with computers and the like? That's one of the strange things. Another strange thing of the interaction between the material and spiritual worlds occurs in Dawnbreakers, when the Bab is escorted as a prisoner of the regime and taken up towards Azerbaijan, and he's in Urmia as a so-called guest of the governor of Urmia. And you may remember the description of what happened in Dawnbreakers. The prince decided he wanted to humiliate the Bab, and so he instructed his groomsmen to bring the Bab a wild horse that had never been ridden before, and his anticipation was that they would bring this wild horse to the Bab would try and ride it, be thrown off the horse, everybody would laugh, and it'd be a subject of ridicule. Okay. It's either somebody breathing deeply or it's a telephone. And you find in Dawnbreakers what happened was that as soon as the horse was brought to the Bab, he quietly approached it, taking hold of the bridle which the groom had offered, gently caressed it, and placed his foot in the stirrup. The horse stood still and motionless beside him, as if conscious of the power which was dominating it. This is a very strange phenomenon. It is a very strange example of the influence between the material and spiritual worlds, and that influence extending to an animal, which, as we know, does not have a spiritual nature. The third strange phenomenon, which I offer as an example of the complexity of the relationship between the material and spiritual worlds, occurs also in Dawnbreakers, and again I'm sure you're familiar with it, at the time of the martyrdom of the Bab in Tabriz. Nabil records in the following: "The very moment the shots were fired, a gale of exceptional severity arose and swept over the entire city. A whirlwind of dust of incredible density obscured the light of the sun and blinded the eyes of the people. The entire city remained enveloped in that darkness from noon until night." Again, an example of the interaction between the material and spiritual dimensions of the creation, this heinous crime of the martyrdom of the Bab, putting to death the manifestation of God, gave rise, it seems, other than that of being an incredible coincidence which stretches credulity, that it gave rise to this weather phenomenon in the city of Tabriz. We say to ourselves, what is the connection? What is our concept of creation that embraces a connection between two such apparently diverse events? My purpose this morning is not to attempt to dissect these three examples, but simply to offer them as indications that we are today plunging into a complicated and rather difficult subject, which is the foundation of our religious belief. As believers, we believe in the existence of the spiritual and material dimensions of creation. They're important to us. One could follow up these examples that I have offered you with innumerable other examples. One of the ones that I find very intriguing is the statement of Abdu'l-Bahá in the Tablet of Purity, in which he says, "Even in the physical realm, cleanliness will conduce to spirituality, as the holy writings clearly state." I find this as mysterious as the others. Why is it that my being clean has an effect upon my spirituality? Surely one would argue that they are irrelevant, that whether I'm clean or dirty should have no effect on my spiritual condition. And such an argument is invalid, because Abdu'l-Bahá says that cleanliness will conduce to spirituality. And of course, we have the various laws of the Kitab-i Aqdas, which develop that theme somewhat further. Another mysterious example of the interaction between the material and spiritual worlds is the concept of hukukula, which in its basic form is that we have a right of God, which we owe to God, of our surplus income minus necessary expenditures, and that our observing the duty to pay hukukula, provided it is done under the appropriate conditions, with joy and radiance and the like, that it will attract great spiritual blessings to us. Again, there's a sense of mystery to it. Why should it be that my handing over 19% of my surplus income minus necessary expenditures should have an effect on my spiritual development and my blessings? How does this differ from a very crude approach to buying one's way into the kingdom of God? What is the difference? These are all issues that derive from the exploration of the relationship between the material and spiritual dimensions of creation. My purpose in presenting these sessions at this summer school is ultimately to address two issues pertinent to it. One issue is, how can we steer a course of conduct which maximizes our spiritual development while we are living in these two worlds? We know that this stage of existence, as we progress through the worlds of God, that this stage of existence is characterized by our living in the material and spiritual worlds simultaneously. Given that being so, how can we maximize our spiritual development by steering an appropriate course of action during this phase of our existence? There are obviously some very obvious things to do, to be nice to people and not tread on small children or kick the cat or anything like that. But there are obviously a lot more subtle and complicated things which are necessary for us as we steer the course of our lives. That's one question. The second question is, how can we internalize our perception of reality of the spiritual dimension so it becomes as real to us as the material forces? The material forces are real to us. If I were to take this watch and drop it, which I'm not going to do because it's my only watch, but if I were to do it, it would fall downwards, wouldn't fall upwards. I wouldn't stop and say, well, let me say, okay, what's the law of graduation and gravitation and F equals mg and all this kind of stuff. I would naturally assume without a moment's thought that if I nudge this thing off the lectern, it'll fall downwards. I have totally internalized the concept of the law of gravitation that it becomes part of my life. Likewise, parents instruct little children not to put their hand on the hot stove because they'll burn their hand. And it becomes a natural part of one's knowledge. The child doesn't have to sit and think and work out a whole bunch of equations of the heating of organic matter, knows that the hand will burn. It's become internalized. It's natural. You know it without thinking about it. And the question I pose is, how can we, in the course of our lives, develop a consciousness which makes it natural to us to know what are the spiritual forces and how they operate in the world, so we steer the appropriate course of action as an automatic part of our behavior. Now, before I proceed, I want to take a diversion. And what I want to do is to take a detour and look at the conventional views about this subject of the relation of the material and spiritual worlds, the conventional view in the world around us. In other words, what I'm saying to myself is, what do most people think about the relationship between the material and spiritual worlds? I say this because we are unconsciously affected by what most people think. We pretend we're not, but in fact we are. I have divided my analysis of what most people think into three categories. And obviously there are generalizations in so doing, and you can think of a fourth category, and why did I mention that, and so on. The broadest category, unfortunately, at the present time, are those who ignore the existence of the spiritual dimension of creation. We live at this time in what is largely a world of people who accept only the material dimension of creation, who give no credence to to the spiritual dimension of creation, and even if they do, they regard it as totally irrelevant to day-to-day life. They ignore the existence of that spiritual world, this sense of paying no heed to it is reinforced by peer behavior, by the media, and by social commentators. Our perception of the interaction between the material and spiritual worlds is far different. For example, it seems to me that one of the central themes of the book Promised Day Is Come is that Shoghi Effendi takes the tablets of Baha'u'llah to the kings and religious leaders and relates their rejection of his claim to their fate in years that followed. One of the things that happened was that Napoleon III was defeated by the Germans, the Battle of Sedan, and lost his kingdom and went off into exile. We know this to be the fundamental cause of his defeat because it is so stated in the writings of the faith, including statements of Baha'u'llah. Now, if you're a poor student doing an essay in history and you put down that the reason why Napoleon III lost his empire was because he rejected Baha'u'llah, you may want to choose another course of study because they're going to be very quickly throw you out of this one. There are lots of other things in the writings of the faith where the Baha'i concept is radically different from the materialistic concept of the world around us. Our concept of what's happening in the world today is governed by our model of two processes of decline and growth, as described by The Guardian in Unfoldment of World Civilization. This is quite different from the analyses prevalent in the world around us, analyses of the contemporary events in the world. One of the most striking comments of Shoghi Effendi in the latter pages of Adam and Divine Justice is where he refers to the American nation and people being moved by forces they can neither comprehend nor control in the evolution toward the spiritual destiny of America. This is an alarming statement. If you take some red-blooded right-wing American and say, you know, your nation is being moved by forces it can neither comprehend nor control, you'll find he or she will be somewhat upset at you for even daring to suggest such a comment. But it's part of our writings. It is a derivative of our perspective that's a non-materialistic perspective of creation. So one category of those who ignore all this spiritual stuff, it's all about superstition and vagueness and the like, and who proceed with the material perception of creation and make their decisions accordingly. Second category are those who think, well, there is something there, but I'm not sure what it is, and it's certainly not in Orthodox religion. And there's a fair number of such people. They believe that there are spiritual forces at work in the world, but they're not confined by religious teachings. You find in many instances these are people who subscribe to ritual practices, who have superstitions, or who put a great reliance on lucky charms and talismans. You find, for example, if you read interviews with some sporting figures, they say, I never will go on the field without my rabbit's foot or my favorite item that I had as a child, which brings me good luck, and without it I won't be successful in the match tomorrow. So all kinds of things exist in our society where people put great reliance on practices which are essentially superstitious because they believe there is something there, better not fool around with it or get into all kinds of trouble, follow it very slavishly, although it's not part of an organized system of religious belief. The third category are those who are part of an orthodox religion. Again, of course, there are a wide variety, but what I have concluded in looking at this subject, that a lot of the followers of the mainstream religions of the world regard the material and spiritual dimensions of creation as antagonistic. In other words, either one or other. If you want to be spiritual, don't get too involved in material things. If you get very much involved in material things, then the penalty is that it will be a barrier to your spiritual development. So you find in this category of orthodox religion or conventional religion, there is confusion between material possessions and materialism. Somebody who has lots of goods and big air-conditioned house and drives a Rolls-Royce or a Cadillac or something like that must be materialistic. We associate one with the other in an invalid way. In some instances, the followers of conventional religion look with distrust upon engagement in business and commerce. They say, don't get into that, it'll make you unspiritual. It'll take you away from the spiritual purpose in life. And you find occasionally you read the biography of an individual who was very successful in, say, business and commerce, but consciously chose to withdraw from it as an approach to becoming so-called spiritual. Again, a reflection of a worldview of antagonism between matter and spirit. I have met a number of people who regard the use of modern technology and labor-saving devices as something that is unspiritual. It's better to live the way people used to live in the 18th century or earlier, because that's more spiritual, because you have various Christian denominations that are like that and are trying to recover the spirit of the early Christian faith through their abhorrence of modern technology and modern devices. There are those who associate spirituality with impracticality. I remember when I was a student at Sydney University, a group of friends of mine came to me one time during the long vacation. I was still at university doing something, and they said, we want you to meet a friend of ours. He's very spiritual. That's very interesting. Sydney University is not known for that, but anyhow. So I said, how do you know he's very spiritual? And they say, well, he spends all day in his room looking at a lighted candle. And by their definition, he must be spiritual, because somebody who engages in an impractical form of behavior like that, by definition, has rejected a lot of material things and therefore is spiritual. And I don't tell you this story in a spirit of looking down on those who gave it to me, but rather as an example of a prevailing way of thought. You find also that a number of people who claim to be spiritual distrust logic and rationality. It's either the province of the devil or it's something designed to take you away from the spiritual dimension of creation. So all of these things are phenomena within humanity struggling, often within the confines of organized religion, struggling to resolve the question of the relationship between matter and spirit. There are obviously extreme forms. The Shias at Ashura, who self-flagellation, who beat themselves with whips and draw blood on their back, do so not only as a means of identifying with the sufferings of the Imam Hussein and his companions, but also as a means of spiritual development, to mortify the flesh, to subject oneself deliberately to pain as a means of getting away from the material world and therefore becoming more spiritual. The concept of celibacy in religious terms has these underlying perspectives on it of having abandoned any thought of sexual conduct as expressed in conventional religion, regard that as a means of becoming even more spiritual than the run-of-the-mill. And of course, the view in a number of religions that one should withdraw from the world to live in a monastery or a cave or some secluded setting as a means of spiritual development is quite established. If you look at the history of medieval Christianity as well as Hinduism and Islam and other religions, you find there was the attraction to withdrawal to the desert, cave, monastery as a means of developing oneself spiritually. Again, a reflection of this apparent antagonism between matter and spirit. So much for the conventional view. That was a detour. What we want to do is to get back on the road and proceed the direction in which we wanted to go, and that is to examine the Baha'i teachings on this subject of the relationship between the material and spiritual worlds. What I want to do this morning in the remainder of this session is to enumerate certain what I regard to be underlying Baha'i principles. What this means is that you'll come to the end of this session hungry. So he never got to it. All he did was set out those principles. So what? This is a cheap way of getting you to come back tomorrow. Because tomorrow, those of you who can still remember what we did today, tomorrow we will be able to start putting the thing together in this so-called magnetic principle of Abdu'l-Bahá, which will draw upon these principles I'm going to discuss today. And the following day we'll add time to the dimension of it, of the development over time, and the final day we'll add space in terms of the development in the social context. So let me now take the remainder of the time allotted to me this morning to set out the what seem to me to be the relevant Baha'i principles. There's eight of them. You might say, why aren't there nine? The answer's very simple. I couldn't think of any more. The first of these eight is the statement, and these are things that I think many of them are familiar to you already. There's nothing terribly novel about that, is our writings, as I understand it, tell us that man is a spiritual being with two natures, a spiritual nature and a material nature. As Abdu'l-Bahá explains, in man there are two natures, his spiritual or higher nature and his lower or material nature. In one he approaches God, in the other he lives for the world alone. And Abdu'l-Bahá tells us that our purpose in life is to develop our latent spiritual attributes by which we attain a knowledge of God and we carry out the worship of God by revealing the excellence of his handiwork. All of that seems very straightforward and the like, but in fact it is somewhat revolutionary. We don't believe in the doctrine of original sin. We see man as not purely of a spiritual nature, but also having a material nature. We are capable of doing dreadful things to each other, horrific tortures and paedophilia and all kinds of horrors human beings inflict upon each other. The material nature is not to be ignored. But we also have a spiritual nature, a capacity for good, a capacity to reach out beyond ourselves, to transcend our innate nature, to do wonderful things, things that are heroic, things that are inspiring to those who come after us. But we have the two natures and we must struggle with one against the other. And of course, as part of this is the fact that we are here with a purpose. Our purpose is not simply to play golf every afternoon or to go out on the bay every weekend or anything like that. We have a principal purpose in life which we are expected to fulfill before life passes us by. That's the first one. Second one is a little more messy. My understanding is the writings tell us that the material world is for our training. It's not intrinsically evil. If it were, then fine. Flee the world, get away from it. Go off and live in a cave or a monastery. And get away from daily commerce and the like. But our writings tell us that the material creation is here for our training. The passage in writings that say, I have ordained for thy training every atom in existence and the essence of all created things. Abdu'l-Bahá says, in creation there is no evil, all is good. And he says that desire is a praiseworthy quality provided it is used suitably. We do not seek the extinction of desire, but rather its channeling into constructive ends. That's all very well and good. So far it makes sense that we are here plunked down in this material creation. It's here for our training. But now comes a little problem. The little problem is this, that the writings tell us, and it looks like a horrible contradiction, the writings tell us to free ourselves from the bondage and corruption of the world. Now, good. Now we have a little problem. It was just what I wanted that time. We have a little problem. Here we're saying the creation is for our training to developers and the like, and we say, yes, thank you very much for telling me that. Now we seem to have said the opposite. Now we seem to have said, and it's a quotation from the writings, free yourself from the bondage and corruption of the world. And one reacts by saying, please make up your mind. Either the world is there for our creation, in which case I'll plunge into it and try and make the best I can of it and develop myself spiritually. But on the other hand, you're telling me that I should free myself from the bondage and corruption of the world. How can we resolve this apparent contradiction? Fortunately, it is resolved for us in the writings, in gleanings, because Baha'u'llah goes on to explain what he means by the passage, the world. He says, by the world is meant your unawareness of him who is your maker and your absorption in aught else but him. So Baha'u'llah is saying to us, when I tell you to free yourself from the world, what I'm telling you is to free yourself from unawareness of God and from being absorbed in anything other than the fulfilling the divine will. So it fits together. We should live in this world, we should participate in its events and its development and the like, but don't get carried away to the point of so becoming so absorbed in it that you neglect your spiritual purpose, your awareness of God, the like. And of course, one can see this occurring. People get caught up in the events of the world. It becomes the end in itself rather than the means to fulfilling a higher purpose. So, two down, six to go. We still have time. First was the nature of man. Secondly, the nature of the material world. Third of the 8 points is that our concept of the role of the human being in developing himself or herself spiritually involves practically involving oneself in all dimensions of life. In other words, our concept of the spiritually developed individual does not involve remaining aloof from the practical events of life. I say this because you find passages in the writings where the writings tell us that the role of humanity in this dispensation is to develop cities and countries. And overall, that our purpose in this dispensation is to carry forward an ever-advancing civilization. Well, you're not carrying forward a civilization if you're going off to live by yourself in a cave or in a desert. So our concept of the spiritually developed individual is of a person who involves himself or herself in the practical dimensions of life without getting carried away to divert them from the true purpose of their creation. Fourth point, the Baha'i concept of spiritual development does not include asceticism or puritanism. What these are, as I understand it, are deliberate attempts to make one, to deny oneself the good things of life, things that are pleasant, things that are comfortable, in the name of spiritual development. That's not the Baha'i approach. For example, the writings tell us that Shoghi Effendi points out to us, and then the House of Justice in comment on it, it must be remembered that the maintenance of a high standard of moral conduct is not to be associated or confused with any form of asceticism or excessive and bigoted puritanism. You find that in Orthodox religion, arrogance arises from those who feel they are better than the rest of us because they adopt a more puritanical attitude. People will say, well, I don't go to movies, or I don't watch TV, or I don't read newspapers, or I don't participate in playing any kind of sport, anything like that, because, And then the implication is, I'm more spiritual than you. In other words, there is a tendency in most religions to adopt a hierarchy of puritanical forms of conduct, and the writings tell us that this is not appropriate and not accurate from a Baha'i perspective. There's a very interesting passage of great significance in the questions and answers section, which is an addendum to the Kitab-e Aqdas. And the question arose and was addressed to Baha'u'llah, the question concerning the washing of the feet in water and summer. And Baha'u'llah's response was this: it is the same in both cases. Warm water is preferable, but there can be no objection to cold water. I found this quite profound, because it indicates the direction in which the faith is moving is not one of saying, be big and strong and tough and wash yourself with cold water even in winter. And if you can't, okay, you can have warm water, but you're a softie. It's much better to use cold water. That's not so. The faith, Baha'u'llah points out, warm water is preferable. Make yourself comfortable. Washing your feet is not an end in itself. It's a ablutions preparatory to devotions. And let's not get carried away and make a hierarchy of those who use ice cold water compared to those who use warm water and the like. In other words, I see a philosophic significance to Baha'u'llah's answer to that question. A similar issue arose when Baha'u'llah was expounding the law of Hukukala. A passage arises where the trustees of Hukukala wrote to Baha'u'llah and said that people have pledged themselves to observe maximum austerity in their lives with a view to forwarding the remainder of their income to his exalted presence. This matter was mentioned at his holy court. He said, as Baha'u'llah, let them act with moderation and not impose hardship upon themselves. We would like them both to enjoy a life that is well-pleasing. Again, I see that profound significance that the faith doesn't choose that its followers should observe hardship as an end in itself, but to choose a life that is comfortable. That life may well involve hardship as far as fulfilling one's purpose in service to God and in spiritual development and the like, but it's not deliberately choosing hardship as an end in itself. And that is congruent with the Baha'i view that Puritanism or asceticism is not to be indulged in as part of the path of spiritual development. Four more to go. The next one I want to draw attention to is the passages in the writings which indicate that there is a correspondence, or if you will, a similarity between the material and spiritual worlds. And this is explained by Abdu'l-Bahá, and I'll read the passage he says. It says, the worlds of God are in perfect harmony and correspondence one with another. Each world in this limitless universe is, as it were, a mirror reflecting the history and nature of all the rest. The physical universe is in perfect correspondence with the spiritual or divine realm. The world of matter is an outer expression or facsimile of the inner kingdom of spirit. And Baha'u'llah, Abdu'l-Bahá goes on to make this point again in somewhat similar words. He says, the spiritual world is like unto the phenomenal world. They are the exact counterpoint of each other. Whatever objects appear in this world of existence are the outer pictures of the world of heaven. Now, a lot of this is very obscure because we haven't gone there to take a look at it and come back and told people. But what we do know is what the writings tell us of the correspondence, the pattern between the material world in which we perceive with our senses and the spiritual world to which we will proceed and become more conscious of when we pass to the next world. That they are exact counterpoints of each other. What this means is a wonderful thing. What this means is that we can, and the writings do this, use natural world analogies to convey spiritual truths and principles. Poor soul here is dying of coughing. Would you like some water? Because I got more water than I want to do with here. What we find is that because the material world is an exact counterpart of the spiritual world, that one can convey profound spiritual truths by drawing on examples from the material world. They correspond with each other, and so we can take material world examples to convey deep spiritual truths. So we find that the structure of the Baha'i revelation is that it draws upon material world analogies for that purpose. Let me read a few phrases to you. Trials that attack man like unto the assault of a serpent. Here we're using a material world analogy to convey the nature of the trials that an individual experiences. It's like being assaulted by a serpent. If the writing simply said, the trials that come to you are really pretty bad, yawn. But when it says it's like the assault of a serpent, you know what that means, because a serpent assaulting you is a pretty nasty object. We, as the chairman announced, we lived for 27 years in the Holy Land, and I remember on one occasion a snake tried to get into our house. And Janet very kindly delegated me to deal with it, which is the occasions when equality of the sexes goes out the door. So I took a straw broom and brushed the snake out the front door, and the snake brushed out with the broom and was on the path. The snake was obviously very upset, and so the snake tried to get back at me and the broom. I had the broom at arm's length because the broom I was prepared to sacrifice. And what I remember from that occasion was the so-called assault of a serpent. This beast coiled itself up almost into a loop and would fire off in random directions, operating on a statistical approach that if it chose a number of random directions, then the probability is one of those directions would get this strange object attacking it, which in fact was a straw broom. And I was fascinated by it, by the logic that the snake was using, but also by the fact that it was deeply provoked and it was spending a huge amount of energy reaching out in all directions, random directions, trying to bite the straw broom. So this use of a natural world analogy is governed by the correspondence of the two worlds, material and spiritual, but it conveys things dramatically. On another way, the passage in the prayer that says, it calls upon you to shelter under the wing of thy protection. Think of the images that creates of mother hen with little chickens under its wing. How dramatically it conveys the sense of shelter and comfort that we get from following the way of God and turning to God in prayer. Again, an example of use of the natural world analogy to convey deep spiritual truth, all arising from this correspondence, the exact counterpart of one to the other. And one could go on and on with these. There's another prayer where it says, "Neath the shade of thy protecting wings, let me nestle." Beautiful phrase. The word nestle. "Neath the shade of thy protecting wings." The reference in the prayer, in the divine plan, to this is a broken-winged bird. I think most of us have seen broken-winged bird sometime in our life and how it struggles and how it's desperately it tries to move itself forward even though it can't get off the ground. And it's a very apt description of how one feels on certain occasions. Passage where it says, "Make us the waves of the sea, flowers of the garden," and so on. That make all mankind perfect fruit growing upon the tree of life, and so on. It means several things. The references in the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá to the spiritual world being the exact counterpart of the material world means that deep truth can be conveyed by reference to the material world. It follows from that that people who live close to nature have a unique opportunity to attain wisdom. And you'll find sometimes when you travel in the world and you're with people who live close to nature, they may be island people, they may be farmers, they may be desert people or nomadic people in Mongolia or something like that. Often, not always, but often you find that they have very deep, profound, wise insights into the operation of the spiritual world through being so close to the material world in their daily life. It also means that we should value nature, should be sensitive to nature around us, and that we should cultivate beauty in the natural world, not only as an end in itself, not only as part of our worship of God, but also as a vehicle for our spiritual growth. One of the things I've asked myself over the years, not in the sense of questioning the House of Justice, but more in the question sense of obtaining deeper insight, is why is it that we adopt the strategy as a world religion of expending so much effort on maintaining beautiful gardens? Whether it's the gardens at the world center of the faith, or around the Mashriq al-Azkars, or in other places, I've said to myself, why is it that this religion, at an early stage in its development, in contrast to Christianity or Islam or other religions, has deliberately chosen to devote so much of its limited resources to gardens? And the answer I've come up with is because it is part of our way of worship and also because gardens to us are very important, not only as an expression of the beauty of the civilization we'll ultimately construct in the golden age of the cause, but also as a means of a vehicle for our spiritual growth. Okay, we've done five, we have three more left, and we have morning tea approaching. The sixth one of the eight principles that I want to mention is the concept of spirit. And I mention it relatively briefly because we'll develop it somewhat further in the next session. Abdu'l-Bahá says, look into this endless universe. A universal power inevitably exists which encompasses all, directing and regulating all the parts of this infinite creation. In other words, the concept of spirit in the writings is something that's everywhere. Abdu'l-Bahá says in another place, the greatest power in the realm and range of human existence is spirit. The divine breath which animates and pervades all things. It is manifested through creation in different degrees or kingdoms. In other words, this concept of spirit that we have is something that's everywhere, in every nook and cranny in the entire creation, in the space between the electrons and the protons and neutrons in the atom, throughout the galaxies, in the space between galaxies, in the infinitude of space, billions of light years into the future, within ourselves as human beings and those around us. Spirit, we are told, occupies the entire universe, pervades all things. In addition, it seems that this spirit in which we are bathed in the entire length and breadth of the universe, that this spirit becomes intensified on certain occasions. Doesn't mean that it's switched off on other occasions, but it seems like on certain occasions it becomes intensified, whatever that means. The call of God, Abdu'l-Bahá has written, when raised, breathed a new life into the body of mankind and infused a new spirit into the whole creation. It is for this reason the world has been moved to its depths and hearts and consciousness of men have been quickened. So however little we understand the concept of spirit, it's sort of everywhere, all over the place, but in addition it becomes intensified certain occasions such as the coming of the manifestation of God, and in this case the coming of the Promised One. It's a complex subject. I certainly don't claim to understand it at all well. All I can do is recite to you these passages in the writings that indicate that when a manifestation of God comes to mankind, this intensification of spirit occurs and it becomes apparent over a period of time throughout the world of what has occurred in this greater infusion of spirit. Two more to go, number seven and number eight. Number seven is one that I continue to wrestle with and which I'm still struggling to comprehend. I gave a talk about Akukala in Melbourne a few weeks ago, and it also turns up in discussion of Akukala. In a sense, it's fairly straightforward. It's just that its implications are incredible. Abdu'l-Bahá says, it is obvious that all created things are connected one to another by a linkage complete and perfect. Even, for example, as are the members of the human family. The thing that I find very mysterious about it is the kind of phrases Abdu'l-Bahá uses. All created things are connected one to another by a linkage complete and perfect. If you find yourself thinking more and more deeply about that, we may have to lock you up because it is a very mysterious concept. The concept of that we are all linked to each other by connections which are perfect and complete. I've been continuing reading on this subject, and I find that there are passages in some answered questions where Abdu'l-Bahá develops this even further about the connections between individuals with each other. These may be connections simply through the effect of one person on another, the effect of their presence, their appearance, their attitude, their looks, but I think it's even more than that. Abdu'l-Bahá is quite relentless in expressing this point on a number of occasions. Let me read one more occasion. He says, reflect upon the inner realities of the universe, the secret wisdoms involved, the enigmas, the interrelationships, the rules that govern all. And now he goes on the same thing. For every part of the universe is connected with every other part by ties that are very powerful and admit of no imbalance nor any slackening whatever. These are extreme statements. Every part of the universe is connected with every other part by ties that are very powerful. The entire universe is almost like an organic unit of entities which interconnect with each other. If I understood this better, which I don't, it, I think, is the beginning of the basis for understanding this thing I said at the beginning of my presentation about the Kitab-e-Iqan and a sign appearing in the visible heaven with the coming of a manifestation of God. I see that as an example of this interconnection between all elements of creation. And I suspect, as I said in Melbourne, that during the course of this dispensation, we human beings will develop a far more insightful view of the interconnections within the universe around us. Ecology, climate change, pollution, the relation of individuals to others in crowds, and the sense of how a crowd behaves as distinct from the way an individual behaves, the concepts underlying sociology of groups, the like, and all kinds of things. Things that we only barely can comprehend today, I think, will become much more clear during the course of this dispensation. And we will, humanity will develop a deeper understanding of this very profound truth that Abdu'l-Bahá is expounding, of all elements of the universe being interconnected with each other. You find another example of this in some answered questions where Abdu'l-Bahá was asked by Laura Dreyfus Barney about the influence of the stars on the earth. And Abdu'l-Bahá's response was basically that there is an influence of the stars on the earth. He says it's not the conventional astrology, but that there is an influence. We know this to some extent with what we know of cosmic rays and tides of lunar motions and gravitational perturbations and the like, but it's obviously a lot more than that. It's all part of something we're moving towards understanding the interconnection of the various elements of creation. Finally, number eight, and that refers to the fact that one of the principles of our faith in the relationship between the material and spiritual dimensions of creation is that of our aim to achieve what the writings describe as a dynamic coherence between the spiritual and practical requirements of life on earth. We don't seek one to dominate the other. We don't seek to become independent of the material elements of creation, and obviously we don't seek to become independent of the spiritual elements of creation. We don't go to either extremes, but rather we are seeking the two in balance, what the writing has described as a dynamic coherence of material and spiritual elements of creation. And Shoghi Effendi develops that theme in some detail when he speaks about the Mashrikal Azkar and points to the concept of the Mashrikal Azkar, not simply the central house of worship, but all the dependencies around it, as representing a model for the dynamic coherence between the spiritual and the material. And so any survey of our concept of the material and spiritual dimensions of creation must include our aim of dynamic coherence rather than of one extinguishing the other. So this brings me to the end of the presentation. As I said at the beginning, it leaves you somewhat hungry. All we've done is enumerate this set of eight principles, and one is inclined to come to the end of it and say, okay, so what? Well, so what will be tomorrow at 9 a.m. when we start to develop it further.